Messiah might enter.
Exactly. Okay, so I guess we'll start. Why don't we do a quick go around? Pak, do you want to start?
Am I introducing myself?
Yes.
Oh, okay. My name is Pak Povrick, and I'm an editor of the Platypus Review, and I write for a publication called On Verge, and I'm going to be giving this talk today.
Okay. So I guess maybe I'll just move in that in a rough circle. I'm Brian. I'm the NYU chapter head of Platypus. I am a senior at NYU right now. Ross.
Okay. My name is Ross Wolf. I'm a writer. I work... And I'm a member of the Platypus Affiliated Society.
I'm Jeremy Cohen. I'm a man about town and graduate student at NYU, and I'm a member of Platypus.
I'm
Tiffany.
I'm a student at the New School, and the second Platypus thing I've come to.
I'm Simon Medino. I write about architecture for the first event I've been to. I don't know.
I'm James. I'm a student at NYU.
My name is Garrett. It's like the second that I've been to, and musician. I think the topic's interesting. So.
I'm Ben, grad student at Rockefeller University.
I'm Julia.
Cool, thanks.
All right,
so this will be a little bit more schematic than I was planning. I had written a talk and I left it on my USB drive at home, but I have a good sense of what I was going to say. So it might be a little bit more schematic than I was hoping, but I think that the core of it can still be here. So the title of this talk really is, what is the relevance of Marxism, or is there any relevance to Marxism today? But there's also a subtitle to the talk, which is Capital in History. And it's really important to keep this subtitle in mind and its relationship to the title, because there's a very specific implication that's being made here. And that's probably the best way to begin with the subtitle. And really, what does it mean? What does capital in history mean? Basically, there's a long answer, but the fundamental answer to the question is that it means that fundamentally, capitalism is itself a historical phenomenon. It's something that emerges at a particular moment in the history of humanity, and that is in fact quite unprecedented in its development. Because if we do take history to be at least something close to being the study of change over time, how humanity changes over time, then it's really important to understand that capitalism as it develops over the course of quite a long period of time that I'll cover really briefly, it constitutes a radical and epochal shift in human relations and everything that involves human relations. So this is the foundation of capital in history. The foundation, in fact, of capitalism as it emerges, probably the most important thing, I think, if you're thinking about this really schematically, is that capitalism provides the possibility for a radical and unprecedented kind of freedom that is, again, unprecedented in the history of the world. Freedom is really the foundation of capitalism, of modernity, and these capitalism and modernity are broadly synonymous, because capitalism provides the possibility of freeing humanity from the tyranny, first of all, of nature, right? Because with the development of capitalism, you have rapid advances in the sciences, right? There's a long history to this that includes the British Agricultural Revolution, which basically takes place in the 15th through the 18th centuries, that sees rapid strides made in the efficiency of farming technologies. Excuse me a second here. Well, rapid advances in the sciences, rapid advances in the arts as well. What historians now call the early modern period, which is basically inaugurated by the start of the Renaissance in the 16th century, sees rapid advances made in the ability to depict naturalistically, which is in fact bound up very closely with the development of human anatomy. I see Richard rolling his eyes a little bit here, because I know you have your qualms with this. But schematically speaking, there's a shift that's made in the Renaissance where it becomes possible once again, after a long period of abstraction in art, to depict naturalistically once again, which is again bound up with anatomy. There's a Flemish physician whose name is Andreas Vesalius, I believe, if I'm not mistaken here, who in 1543 writes a book, and I'm forgetting the Latin title, but the name of the book in English is On the Fabric of the Human, something like this, which is a book that's really beginning to understand anatomy in ways that are, again, have either been lost or are unprecedented. But basically, what we're seeing broadly in this period is the development of freedom from disease, right? The beginning of a liberation of the tyranny of nature, of disease, of famine, right, with agricultural technology. And this is really the foundation of capitalism, a totally unprecedented kind of freedom. Because, and I know Richard will probably roll his eyes at this as well, in the feudal world, which is the world that immediately precedes capitalism, something that doesn't exist in the way that we understand it today, in the way that we, you know, some people conceive it as existing today, is free exchange, right? And this is another absolutely fundamental aspect of capitalism. What Enlightenment thinkers are sort of beginning to develop is this idea that we can freely sell our own labor to whoever the highest bidder is, right? So we are free to search for work and give our labor to somebody who's willing to pay the highest price, right? This is something that doesn't exist in feudalism because the serf in feudal society is bound to the land, right? They are not producing to give to the lord in order for the lord to allow them to stay on the land. I mean, there's no idea that this relationship can be anything other than exactly what it is. So in this sense, it's fundamentally unfree because there's no imagination of the relationship being any different than what it is, right? Freedom, in part, is the ability to imagine something different than what you have. So in the sense that freedom doesn't exist in feudal society, it's developing over the course of, again, a long history, into the ability for human beings to freely sell their own labor, right? And this is, again, absolutely fundamental to the development of capitalism. But at the same time that you are free to sell your own labor, you're also free to starve, right? Because if you don't have the ability to sell your labor, because again, work is no longer guaranteed, you have to search for it. It's not as if you live, you know, are born on a plot of land and work there because your father worked there. You're free, as you are to work. You're also free at this point to starve if you're unable to, you know, find work for yourself. And this is really the kind of fundamental, well, it's the foundation that this Marx quote that all that's solid melts into air. It's the foundation that it rests on, because with the ability, again, to sell your labor freely and the ability to move, this is another thing that's, you know, only possible with the development of capitalism. People didn't move. You know, you lived where you lived. This is again, fundamental. So freedom really is the foundation upon which capitalism develops. Free to work, but also free to starve. There's more, of course, to this. Part of what's symptomatic of the development of capital, insofar as it is indicative of the development of capital, is also the development of politics, which is also something that doesn't exist in the same way in feudal society. Because now that the worker is free to sell his or her labor to whoever they can, whoever they choose, but whoever is willing to buy it from them, it also means that they are bound up within a world in which people are making their own decisions in a way that they hadn't been prior to the development of capitalism. Because the employer can decide to employ you or not, right? In a way that the feudal lord didn't decide whether or not you were his serf. You just happened to be born somewhere, and this is the way things work. So this is really the development of politics in the sense that we use it today, which is the ability to construct your own world, to make your own decisions in a way that, again, had not existed prior to the development of capitalism. And one of the things that develops out of this ability to make political decisions, and all decisions in fact become political with the development of capital, is the development of a left and a right in politics, right? So this develops directly out of the French Revolution. In the French Revolution, there's a National Assembly. And in the National Assembly, people are seated either on the left or on the right according to how they basically understand that the revolution should be unfolding. People who are sitting on the right, broadly speaking, are still monarchists who believe that the king, Louis XVI, should remain in power, broadly speaking, but that, you know, certain kinds of liberal rights should be granted to the French citizenry. On the left, on the furthest side of the left, is radical republicanism that believes that the king should be deposed, that the feudal monarchy itself should be destroyed, and that a republic should be established. And the ability for this kind of conversation to take place is, again, something that is only possible at a certain moment in history, because politics, as a kind of conversation, as a series of conversations taking place between people who are trying to build their own lives, is something that's only possible with the freedoms that capitalism provides. Fundamental to the French debate that's going on at this time is the question of what to do with the deposed king, with Louis XVI. One of the pivotal figures on the history of the left is Maximilien Robespierre. And Robespierre is a French revolutionary actor who is, you know, again, he's probably the second, maybe the second most controversial figure on the left in the history of the left. I don't know, maybe that's a bit strong, but if Lenin is number one, possibly Robespierre is number two. There's an argument going on at this point about what to do with the king, right? There's an argument taking place as to whether or not to put him on trial. And there is an argument on the right saying that he should not be put on trial, that in fact he should just remain in power, and that we can develop a mechanism for liberal rights within the existing feudal order. And Robespierre, in fact, says something somewhat similar, because he does say, well, in fact, no, the king should not be tried. But the way that he gets to this decision is, in fact, radically different than the way that the right comes to the decision. He gives a speech on August 10th, I believe, 1792. It's called On the Trial of the King, in the way that it's published now. And he says, quote, "There is no question of a trial. Louis is not accused. Louis is not accused. You are not judges. You are only... I'm sorry, you are not judges. You cannot be. You can only be statesmen and representatives of the nation. You have no sentence to render for or against a man, but a measure of public safety to take, an act of national providence to perform." Now, this is indicative of a kind of conversation that would not have been possible prior to the development of capital, to the French Revolution. Now, it's not true the kings had not been executed before, but the reason behind this is that Louis, as Robespierre sees him, is not just a man, but he's an institution. He is the embodiment of the French monarchical, the French monarchy. And the trial is no longer about the king as a man, but about feudal society and all the relations that it entails as a whole. Again, the point being here that this kind of conversation, this kind of free political conversation, is not possible until a certain moment in the history of humanity, and this is indicative of that kind of that moment. But what comes along with this, what comes along with the possibility of politics, is also a major kind of crisis, right? Because the ability to decide what you're going to do with your own life makes people anxious, I suppose, broadly speaking. Probably there's a more historical way to put that, but I think we can all sort of imagine that, that being presented with a series of decisions, you know, can breed a kind of anxiety in people. It generates a kind of crisis that is registered by, very much by, the possibility to have the conversation. Politics, in fact, is the way that we understand it now, and the way that it has been understood in many ways is a series of crises kind of building on one another or following after one another. And the fact that there is such a thing as the left is what, in fact, registers this crisis as clearly as is possible at this moment in the development of human history. Because the left, And there are, you know, any number of figures on the left at this moment. I mean, Thomas Jefferson is, you know, on the left. Adam Smith is on the left. These are people who are partaking in the development of a world, again, that is wholly different and had been unimaginable before a certain moment in the history of humanity. And the left, as it's registering this, is also beginning to register the fact that the world that it's creating, the world of capitalism, is in fact going to make certain kinds of freedoms that it promises impossible. That again, to just repeat quickly, that the things that it wants to make possible, the hopes that it hopes to fulfill, capitalism, in fact are going to be blocked by capitalism itself, right? So again, freedom fulfilled is something that becomes problematic. There's a letter that Thomas Jefferson writes to James Madison in 1785 where he's writing about property relations, and he says, "I'm conscious that an equal division of property is impracticable, but the consequences of this enormous inequality producing so much misery to the bulk of mankind. It is too soon yet in our country to say that every man who cannot find employment but who can find uncultivated land shall have the liberty to cultivate it." This is, again, the registering of, really at the birth of the American Revolution, which is bound up very much within the development of capitalism. It's registering that the left is recognizing, perhaps not fully consciously, that the promises that bourgeois society, the capitalism, advance as very real possibilities, that in fact that capitalism and bourgeois society cannot fulfill these promises itself, right? So the idea that capital, this sort of idea of capital in history, is the understanding, again, to recap, that capital develops at a certain point in history, that its foundation is the possibility of an unprecedented kind of freedom, but that this freedom is in fact going to be blocked by capitalism itself, that the freedoms that it promises are blocked in its own development, right? And this, in fact, is what Marx is registering pretty early on, relatively early on in his career. And there's a quote that he has in a letter that he wrote to Arnold Rouge in 1843, where he says, "It will become evident that it is not a question of drawing a mental divide between past and future, but of realizing the thoughts of the past. Lastly, it will become evident that mankind is not beginning new work, but is consciously carrying into effect its old work." Which is to say that Marx himself is also recognizing, in a much more clearly self-conscious way than Thomas Jefferson would have been able to, because Jefferson is living at a different moment, right? And this is really the key. It's not that Jefferson is some sort of conservative reactionary. He's living in a different moment in history. And Marx is able to register more clearly later on in history that, again, mankind is not beginning new work, but is consciously carrying into effect its old work. Which is to say that the old work, that the realization of the freedoms that capitalism tries to make possible, cannot be fulfilled through capitalism. But that what socialism would be, what socialism is the full realization in some sense, the full flowering, the full manifest, the entirety of capitalism realized. And this itself would be a process, which is important to remember. This is not some kind of event that would take place in some sort of immediate fashion. There are a group of utopian socialists who were living in England and France in the early part of the 19th century who are basically trying to understand socialism as something that can be planned, as something that can be mapped. So Robert Owen is an important British figure in utopian socialism. And Owen designs a series of basically plans for what a socialist world can look like. And he sees it as existing in such a way that there's a central farmhouse. I wish I had the quote. I had it earlier. But there's a central house in the center of a city, right, around which are in which people live, around which are built farms, around which are built schools, and then further off in the distance you have the industrial areas of the city. The idea being here that you can, you know, predict or predetermine or design this world and then implement it, right? And he did try. He went to Indiana as one place that he, number of experiments that he had. One of them was in Indiana. In fact, he never actually ended up going there, but he bought a plot of land. There were a series of buildings set up. It collapsed within a couple of years. And what Marx is understanding, in fact, is that socialism cannot be prefigured in some sort of dogmatic fashion. You can't say, well, here's exactly what it's going to look like, now it's up to us implementing it. But it has to develop from the womb of capitalism. It has to develop historically from the things that capitalism promises but itself cannot fulfill. It must develop in such a way as to understand that socialism itself would be a radically different kind of world that itself would emerge historically out of a particular moment. This idea of socialism being the full flowering of capitalism is not really something that's discussed very much today, which really kind of, I think, signals how far we are, politically and historically, from the people that believed this at a certain moment in history. Even Lenin would have understood this pretty clearly. Lenin, in December of 1917, writes a letter, I believe it's a letter, in fact, it might be an article, but it's called How to Organize Production. And what he writes in this, in the second or third paragraph, is, quote, "Far from extinguishing competition, socialism, on the contrary, for the first time, creates the opportunity for employing it on a really wide and a really mass scale, for actually drawing the majority of working people into a field of labor in which they can display their abilities, develop their capacities, and reveal those talents, so abundant among the people whom capitalism crushed, suppressed, and strangled in thousands and millions." Again, this is really an important point, right? The idea is that capitalism cannot fulfill the promises that it wants to fulfill. It doesn't even make competition possible. I mean, this is the foundation of capitalism is that we should all be on a level playing field and that we should all be able to compete for X, Y, and Z. It doesn't even make that possible, right? We're not even free to do that. And this is what Lenin is registering at this moment in history. So this is something that was truly fundamental at a certain point to Marxism, but seems to be no more. I mean, this idea of capital in history. Capitalism is a stage in the development of history. History understood as the progressive move towards greater and greater freedoms, right? Capitalism is one step, not the final step, but as one move in the, you know, longer trajectory. This is something that this notion isn't really discussed as much as it would have been before, or in fact before it would have been understood maybe without as much explicit discussion. Yeah. I have just a couple more minutes. I'm almost done. Yeah. So this is really what capital in history is. But then that still leaves the question of whether or not Marxism is relevant, right? Because this is the title of the talk. And in fact, it's not clear what the answer to that question is. It's not clear. Because in the absence of the possibility for a truly radical and revolutionary change in every aspect of our lives, radical insofar as it goes to the root, changes fundamentally every aspect of our lives, in the absence of that, it's not clear that Marxism is relevant. Because what Marxism does, or had done, was make self-conscious that possibility. And without the possibility to make self-conscious, Marxism may in fact not be relevant. It's not clear, right? I'm not going to sit here and tell you that, you know, Marxism certainly makes sense. And but there, this is really the question of Marxism, because of course, as Marx said, you know, what's the quote? Hitherto philosophers have only interpreted the world; the point is to change it. That's my talk. I'm done. Yeah, you had a...
My question was that you were talking about the stage of capitalism and how, you know, mapping it out. Well, not necessarily mapping it out, but basically aren't the three stages of capitalism, mercantile, industrial, and corporate capitalism, which is the current phase right now, wouldn't the next step only be fascism?
It is true that fascism itself is also symptomatic of capitalism, because it can only develop, again, within a world of capitalism. There's no, you know, possibility of imagining what fascism would have been before the development of capitalism. So it's true that it's symptomatic, right? I mean, it indicates, right, as a symptom does. But it's not clear that, you know, history necessarily moves in any one direction, right? I mean, things can move in any number of different ways. There's a lot of argument about, you know, if there are stages of capitalism, what they would be, you know. So I don't know that, you know, it would necessarily be that. But it is true that fascism emerges as a result of, partly as a result of a failed revolution in Germany that takes place in the teens, or before the teens, rather. What are the years of the
1923.
Okay. So, in fact, the failure of a Marxist revolution is the breeding ground for the development of fascism. And Marxism itself is a symptom of capital, right? Because it itself can only develop as something that can, like, indicate that capitalism exists, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I hope I'm answering your question.
No, but I mean, maybe I said it the wrong way, but not that I'm categorizing the stages of capitalism, but that's how it's basically unfolded from mercantilism into now the corporate phase. So basically, we are living in a fascist country already because the definition of fascism is corporate and government power merging, then we already have that with our politicians being bought and sold on Capitol Hill. They already own the politicians, so their interests are being furthered through their power over the politicians, and that looks like the merging of corporate and government power to me.
Is it?
Well, yeah, I was just going to make a stab response to that. I mean, it seems to me that you know, Fox attempts to give the term fascism, like this character being like a symptom of something, right? Is to try and treat it as more bound up with a moment of kind of acute possibilities. I mean, that's the point I'm trying to draw attention to, the way that it's situated in the failure of the revolution.
Right.
It wasn't just in Germany, but of course, I mean, there the anecdote is simply that, you know, the revolutionaries who were partaking and who led that moment, 1919 forward, were murdered by paramilitaries who later become Nazis.
Who would have called themselves Marxists? Some of them.
Well,
I mean, maybe not the
individual.
Yeah.
But anyways, my point is simply to say that you have this real distinct possibility. In Russia, you actually do have a successful revolution to an extent for socialism. And that gives rise to kind of social contradictions and a kind of crisis of society that produces something on the order of fascism as we understand it. Today the question is, you know, not so much do we live in fascism as can we even recognize the political kind of context that we do exist in without those types of manifest kind of acute symptoms.
I want to respond. First of all, I would say very clearly we do not live on fascism, and there's no indication that heading towards it here. And if we were, we're talking about whether it was wasted, we wouldn't be having this meeting. I mean, one of the things that actually happened in Germany, and one of the reasons the Nazis took power, is that the Communist Party had an extremely sectarian attitude that said that the Social Democrats are just as bad as the Nazis, which obviously was not the case, because the moment the Nazis came to power, all the leftists were put in prison. And a lot of people in the early 30s were saying that under, you know, the ruling of these conservative right-wing regimes that preceded the Nazis, that, you know, how could things get any better? That they were already living under fascism. But they were not already living under fascism. And things became dramatically worse when they were really living under fascism. I mean, in this country, we're going to have an election in a few months. And the outcome of that election will make very little difference. But that's not because we live under fascism, it's because we have two political parties that represent basically the same thing. But that's very different from living under fascism or living under an actual police state where dissidents are put into concentration.
Don't we live in a police state? Wasn't Martin Luther King assassinated by COINTELPRO, and so were Fred Hampton, were assassinating revolutionaries, infiltrating movements? Not only that, but you could just look at the policies put in place by George W. Bush as fascist, such as the Homeland Security Act, homeland being a fascist term, referring to fatherland like Nazi Germany. That in itself is a fascist policy which allows the police state to further their interest by congregating a dossier of national providence. They have all this data bank of all these people's information. That's police state. Then you also have the Patriot Act, which was fascist unto itself. So I feel like it's a veil. You know, it's just a veil. And when it's lifted, it'll certainly get worse. We're not really experiencing the effects fully of what they're capable of. But as you can see, we're moving in that. I mean, not everybody might agree with me, but I feel that that's the direction we're moving in, especially with the concentration and wealth being greater than at any other point in human history. Like, the 1% owns 50% of the country's wealth, you know, what is that? You know, I mean, we have to question ourselves. And you were definitely right, like, in everything you said about it not being able to provide what it says capitalism doesn't even provide an even playing field. But, you know, so then what are we living in that? What I can question, you know?
Yeah, go ahead, guys. I won't call in. Don't worry. Okay. Just go ahead, because well, if I can just say really quickly, I mean, the beginning of the talk was really about how capitalism makes possible a kind of freedom that is unprecedented in the history of humanity. And in very real ways, that does still exist, right? It's just that it cannot be itself fulfilled within the world in which we live. I mean, again, you know, the fact that we will have an election in, you know, a month and a half, the fact that we can sit in this room and do this, there are very real kinds of freedoms that we do have. It's just that they themselves are also restricted, right? I mean, something that I was thinking about the other day is that if you live in New York State and you vote, and if you vote for, you know, for president, it sort of doesn't really matter who you vote for, because Obama's going to win the state, and the way that the Electoral College works is that, you know, states, you vote for electors, and there's a certain number of votes. So insofar as I'm free to cast a vote, my vote, in fact, is meaningless, right? And this is a very real way in which I am free, in a very real way, but my freedom is restricted by the construction of a particular set of political circumstances that means my vote doesn't mean much, right? So this is, I think it's really important to remember that there are very real freedoms, but they themselves are restricted. I mean, you know, I'm wary about the word fascism because we're not, like, rounding people up and putting them in gas chambers, you know?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like the stages of capitalism, there's a lot of debate as to what they are. It's usually, I mean, there's a sort of general consensus. There's a sort of mercantile phase, followed by a liberal phase where they eliminated protectionism and tariffs and so on, followed by recentralization through monopolies and, you know, leading to competitive imperialism. The imperialism that Lenin was talking about, for example, in Europe right before the First World War, is very different from anything that we can call imperialism today. In those times, imperialist powers tended to fight each other and have colonies and so on. Today, it's more or less just a sort of global hegemony of one superpower or two, maybe a block of, you know, superpowers with Russia, China, European Union, and so on. After that, I mean, really the moment of fascism that I, as I understand it, was a sort of seeking a sort of third way of politics between what had emerged as communism or a sort of socialist alternative to existing capitalist relations and the status quo of capitalism. So those who were dissatisfied with capitalism on the one hand, I mean, the Nazis had a lot of very anti-capitalist rhetoric. I mean, they identified largely capital and the kind of havoc that it wreaked upon society as being characteristic of the Jew. That was sort of the figure in which contained all of these categories for them. But on the other hand, I mean, really, there were multiple third-way politics, which is always why I'm kind of wary of, like, you know, it's trying to find a middle ground between, you know, socialism or barbarism, which is, I mean, there was in America there was the New Deal and there was Roosevelt. When the cards, you know, when the dominoes fell down in the way that things played out in the Second World War was that an alliance, including, you know, then actually existing socialism, the Soviet Union, and powers led primarily by the United States because of its military strength and its the nuclear technology that it acquired. That really inaugurated a sort of post-war Keynesianism, a sort of welfare state that
that is now today in ruins or is dissolving rapidly. That's why it's often regarded as neoliberalism, a sort of return to deregulation and sort of flexible capital. The question for me is, you know, whether neoliberalism as a sort of kind of capital still, how it either undermines possibilities for transformation that previously did exist, or it forecloses them. I mean, is there something about the way that capital is sort of spinning out of control, or this sort of perpetual cycle of crises that is standing in the way of politics as they once existed? Or is it actually just a sort of the history of accumulated political failures that, or is there some relationship between the two? Like, is neoliberalism a symptom of the failure to overcome capitalism?
Go ahead, Ben. I want to make sure
that point directly. I mean, I think I should just identify myself also. I lead the reading group here, and it's interesting that you bring up the issue of fascism, because next week we're reading Wilhelm Reich's The Mass Psychology of Fascism, the first chapter. Anyways, but just a little plug. But I think that you know, on the question of fascism, I think maybe the more kind of pointing way for us to think about it is, what does it mean that we live in a post-fascist world? Not so much do we live like on the brink of fascism, but rather that fascism is already a historical fact, occurred. And occurred in a way that wasn't just simply like defeated because the Allies won, but rather, I mean, obviously politically, in terms of like, the state formations, fascism doesn't really exist when you do have like authoritarian regimes that certainly
approximate it. Belarus.
Hmm?
Belarus. Like,
yeah, I mean, you know, sort of. However you want. I mean, there's also, you know, a lot of kind of lingering states that kind of retain some of the characteristics and even more deformed and distorted ways of the earlier part of the century. But really, you know, fascism as a political formation is gone, although I do agree that it's kind of has a character of that defines something of the nature of our kind of social relations today. But we live in a way, in a post-fascist world.
Hi.
And that, for me, is a problem, right? Because, you know, what was fascism is nothing but the kind of, like, brinkmanship of society, of, you know, that's what it meant to talk about socialism or barbarism. Mm-hmm. You know, what does it mean to say that, well, we kind of reached that point and then went beyond it? You know, I think that's maybe why we pose the, you know, topic of today's discussion is, does Marxism even matter? Because, of course, it did matter when there was, like, a choice on the table, like, which way forward, socialism or barbarism? Well, obviously, Marxism is pertinent to one of those. But, you know, in the world in which barbarism has already occurred, fascism is a historical fact. Socialism is, of course, a dead fact. I mean, it's something of our world, but it's dead. You know, it only really exists in that way. You know, what relevance can we ascribe to Marxism in that context? I think that that's the kind of like, way that you have to reframe it. Mm-hmm. I mean, rather than thinking of it in terms of, like, stages and, like, how can we see, you know, how it's going to wind, how the wind of toy is going to, like, kind of play itself out. The other thing is simply to draw the attention to the question of politics. You know, it's not so much a matter of, like, which economic phase is going to occur and what does that mean. It's not really, like, oh, well, what does it mean to live in neoliberalism so much as what does it mean to live in the absence of the left, the death of the left, the, you know, the end of an era that was defined by Marxism as this kind of most... perceptive consciousness. And I think that to pose the question that way, you know, then leads us into interrogating issues like, well, what does it mean to live in the neoliberal era in a much more different way? You know, not what are the politics that are grounded in this economic system, but, you know, what is the political context that allows for just like the, you know, ever-accumulating kind of wreckage of a bourgeois society to just build up without...
Yeah, if I could just, like, I mean, it's very short. It's interesting because arguably the sort of final death agony of Marxist consciousness coincided more or less with the crumbling of Fordism and the birth of neoliberalism in the early 70s. It depends. I mean, that takes for granted a lot of assumptions about periodization and so on. But my question even further is that, you know, is something like fascism as a sort of alternative or third way even imaginable in a world that doesn't have Marxism or socialism as a real alternative? The question today, there doesn't seem, I mean, socialism or barbarism doesn't make sense because socialism doesn't stand in any sort of immediate way that it can realize itself, not in the way that it did 100 years ago. And insofar as fascism is this sort of like reaction to the attempt to transform and transcend the barbarism into which civilization, you know, fell, is it even possible to imagine something as at least, you know, what the fascists thought of as radical or revolutionary? Or is it just rather a sort of like dull, grim, gray banality, you know, just descending into further decay?
Well, I have to say something, because I heard you mention that we live in a post-fascist world, and I heard you mention that we're not putting people in concentration camps, and that it's not autocratic, we have elections. Even though the vote doesn't count, but wouldn't that be contradictory to himself?
Yeah.
The vote is irrelevant, so the freedom is not even there. So, what's the definition of a concentration camp? A camp in where there is a concentration of a certain ethnic people. Our prisons are built on the concentration of blacks and Latinos, which have free labor. Those are concentration camps. We have over 3 million people in those in the prisons of the United States. The United States has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the prison population of the world, which exceeds China, which has 3 times the amount of people. It has 1 billion people. We only have 350 million. So those are concentration camps. Talk about, we're not genociding people. What about in the Middle East? Droning, bombing innocent people because of their religion, because we think they're terrorists, which don't exist. What about the 100 million Native Americans, which this country was built on? That genocide was the biggest in human history. Hitler had nothing on that. 16 million people is nothing compared to 100 million. Also, with the election, we just have the same figure with a different mask on every 4 to 8 years. That doesn't mean anything. You understand what I'm saying? He was very right when he said it's irrelevant whether we have Obama or Romney, because Obama is just as dangerous, if not more, than Romney, with his false hope and saying that he will bring about some sort of social concessionary change to the poor people, which he will not do. He's deported more immigrants than George W. Bush. He's bombing 6 nations in Africa simultaneously as we speak. You know, these are things that cannot be ignored, as well as the NDAA, National Defense Authorization Act, which was passed as of January 2012, which is the most fascist legislation that has been passed in this country's history, which gives the military the right to detain any American indefinitely without the right to trial and without the right to counsel.
What is the relevance of Marxism to that, you know, reality, right? I mean, that horrific, you know, that litany of horror that is our world, what is Marxism's relevancy to it?
I think, right? I mean, this is actually something similar to what I was going to say. I think that nobody would deny that these are like very real, present, immediate concerns, right? And then the question is, what kind of a politics can we develop right now to address them very clearly? Because it becomes like this laundry list of things that becomes so unimaginable to even begin to deal with, right? And this is what it means to have a kind of dead political imagination, right? To consider these problems as actually being solvable. Because most people just sort of, you know, hear this list of things, right, and it becomes so kind of paralyzing, right, because it's just a laundry list of things that are very real, very immediate, very present, but it becomes impossible to imagine actually truly radically solving them instead of addressing them, you know, piecemeal, little by little. And this is the question of whether or not Marxism is relevant, because at a certain point in the history of humanity, right, it became a very real possibility to address things like this, right, in a way that now we have a hard time imagining, right? I think that's the core of this, is that these are immediate, and I don't think anybody would say that these aren't, like, absolutely immediate threats and present dangers. And so what do we do about them? And it's not clear right now what the solution to these things is, right? It's unclear.
I mean, I would say, Mark, but its relevance, realistically in the world, especially in America, is so blatantly and forcibly suppressed.
Do you think that Marxism is best characterized as being an ideology of anti-oppression? I think this is where, like, you know, Platypus perhaps departs more from the rest of the left, in that, you know, not that the, you know, impulse against, to act against, to, you know, organize against oppression is in any way being treated bad, so much as it's itself incapable of grasping the ways in which that circumstance would be overcome. And Marxism, I think, you know, in the context that Fox tried to lay out as far as this historical development of freedom that we understand to be, you know, bourgeois society, is to say that Marxism is a consciousness of freedom, even in its kind of self-contradiction, which, of course, you know, is experienced through all forms of manifest oppression, the way in which freedom is comes into forms of self-contradiction. But I think that to treat it as simply a matter of anti-oppression is to reduce it to an ideology that, you know, wouldn't be distinct to the modern era, wouldn't be distinct to the kind of historical possibilities as they arise and emerge in this historical epoch. And so, you know, meaning, you know, slaves didn't like the slavery in prior to capitalism and would see their master as, you know, the evil, and they would, you know, oppose it. You know, I suppose Jesus himself, you know, had an ideology of anti-oppression in a certain way. The question is, you know, what makes Marxism historically relevant in this epoch, in this era?
That's what I was saying, I'd say it's cool.
Is this not the oppression? Well, right, I mean, but you're... I think we agree that it has no purchase in the sense of actual, you know, practical politics today. You know, there's handfuls of rooms of Marxist intellectuals or Marxist activists kind of dialoguing with each other, like, sporadically across the country.
If I could interrupt, they have food. Interrupt this discussion of the failure of Marxism.
Can I slightly change the subject? Because I was rolling my eyes when you were coming from the right when you said that art progressed. And I wouldn't know how to get into that, because I think that's one of the points. Like, if you're saying that...
So we have food. We also have publications, and I would encourage you to sign up for our email list. Just a quick caveat on the publications. We don't have any view for ourselves. Our goal is to host the conversation. So people submit articles and they hash it out on the pages.
I shouldn't have used the word progress.
So I encourage you to get food, take our publications.
Okay, but
it's free, and sign up.
You have a point about the question of the Marxism and its spiritual imagination, which is sort of like where...
Also, we also have vegetarian
authors, like,
people that
there
are
vegan, does modernity,
yeah,
like, you think of, like,
yeah.
Did you pass around this
book? Offer spiritual possibilities to human beings?
We publish, yeah.
I mean, that, I think that that's actually, like at least in some ways, the most interesting point. Great, you know, this question, like, you know, is the art of the 19th